Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning, Henry Frein. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about one of the most written about figures in the history of the Old West, Billy the Kid. And our guest for the program is Michael Wallace. He's the author of a book that's titled Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. It's out now in paperback, published by W.W. Norton. In the preface to the book, he observes that hundreds of works have been written about Billy the Kid. He writes, some are well-researched and reliable, but far more are historically exaggerated or embroidered with sensational lies. He says that there is an awful lot that we don't know about him. At least he says that there's a lot of disagreement about who his parents were, where he was born, where he died, the circumstances. He says in his book that this is his attempt to present a clear, concise, and truthful story of a young man who became a legend in his time. So we'll be talking about Billy the Kid and what can be known, perhaps what not, this morning in this part of the show with Michael Wallace. He is the author of a number of books. In fact, he's published over 14. He's won a number of honors and awards for his writing. He's the author of the acclaimed Pretty Boy, The Life of Charles Arthur Floyd. He also helped bring about the great revival of Route 66 in the 90s with his book Route 66 that became a big bestseller. He's a member of the Oklahoma Writers Hall of Fame and lectures nationally and is often interviewed on television and on radio. And we're pleased that he could spend some time with us this morning talking about Billy the Kid. Questions, of course, are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just are brief so that we can brief in their comments so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or on the Internet in the United States, use that number, 800-222-9455. And if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, use the local line, and that is 333-9455. Mr. Wallace, hello.
Good morning, David. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Why is it you think that we are so fascinated by characters like Billy the Kid?
I think we always have been. Immediately what comes to mind is a quote that I used actually as an epigraph for the opening of one of my chapters in the book. And it's a quote from Oscar Wilde, of all people, who during a tour of America in 1882, actually between the shooting deaths of the Kid and Jesse James, the following year, in a stop in Denver, Wilde said, Americans have always loved their heroes, and they tend to take them from the outlaw class. And I think that's true even to today. We've had this love-hate relationship with our bad boys and girls, and especially the ones such as the Kid, who have been so mythologized and become mired and legend and fable and sometimes outright lies.
Yeah. Well, certainly this is a story that has grown in the telling in so many different versions, starting probably with Pat Garrett, the man who killed Billy.
Yeah, Garrett, the lawman who killed Billy, and we're pretty confident that did occur on Bastille Day of 1881 at Fort Sumner, New Mexico. Garrett, soon after that, penned, with the help of a ghostwriter, his own take on the Kid, and that served really as the blueprint for a host of other writers and journalists and folks who attempted to interpret the life of this young man, sometimes portrayed as an avenging angel and sometimes as the devil incarnate.
generally, I gather, generally, people believe that he was born in New York, New York City.
That's correct, yes.
And that, was, yeah, no, sorry. Go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm one of those. Out of all the theories of his nativity, I feel pretty confident that he was indeed born to a famine Irish widow in the teeming Irish slums in New York in 1859, and that he and his mother and brother Josie spent some time there through the Civil War and then begin their westward journey, their own little manifest destiny.
They moved to Indiana, then mm-hmm. they moved to New Mexico, then am I missing a stop?
Yeah,
oh, Kansas, which they lived in Wichita.
Wichita.
Yeah.
Wichita and then briefly in Denver. In Indiana, after the Civil War in Indianapolis, Catherine McCarty, the kid's mother, took up with a Union veteran named William Antrim, and they became a couple. And the four of them then, the two boys and the two adults, moved to Wichita, which was really on the western frontier and soon to be a major cow town and trailhead. And it was pretty rough and rugged. And it was there in Wichita during their time there that Catherine was diagnosed with tuberculosis, or galloping consumption, which was the disease of the hour there for many years. Yeah. And that drove them west. It put made them gypsy-footed, and they tried Denver and a better climb, and then eventually down into the havens of the high air and altitude and big skies of New Mexico, where the story of the kid unfolds as really most people only associate him with New Mexico without realizing that he made this eastward out to the west pilgrimage.
Yeah. So we believe that he was born in New York City. His mother was this woman named Catherine McCarty. We don't know who his father was. Shortly after the Civil War, he and his mother and a brother moved to Indiana. She met this man named William Antrim, and then they moved on to Wichita, lived some other places, eventually ended up in New Mexico, where she, Catherine McCarty, dies in the fall of 1874 of tuberculosis. Henry McCarty was his given name when he was born. He was only 14 years old. So that it seemed like, I suppose, a lot of people concentrate in thinking about the experiences that made him who he was in the things that happened to him from that point forward. What can you say about Henry McCarty and his life, say, between the time that he was born and the time that his mother dies?
It was pretty much the story of a lot of youth from that time that were moving west, that were caught up in this westward journey, this fulfillment of manifest destiny. They were part of the foot soldiers of that whole movement after the Civil War, where the big industries of the West, the mining, cattle, and such were growing and import and so forth. He had a very good relationship with his mother. She eventually married Antrim, and in fact, the kid and his brother were witnesses in Santa Fe at the marriage in the Presbyterian Church there, which still stands just off the plaza a few blocks. But he never had a strong relationship with his stepfather. Mm-hmm. But Antrim was more involved in mining and so forth. So the good close relationship with an adult, his mother, when that ended abruptly with her death down in Silver City, New Mexico, when he was just this 14-year-old kid, that was a rude occurrence. I mean, here he and his brother were literally out on the street because Antrim could have cared less about them, and they were boys of the road, fending for themselves, and that's when his survival skills really had to kick in. It was sink or swim, literally.
Yeah. It seems like he's someone who hooks up at least early on in his life with some older men who end up being mentors, but perhaps also bad influences. You sort of wonder, this is being an amateur psychologist, I know, but you sort of wonder whether this wasn't a young man who was looking for a father.
Well, I think so. You know, and others have suggested that as well. I of course always try to stay and feel I do stay objective, and I don't certainly I'm trying to do just the opposite of romanticize the kid, because I think the true story is a much better story, and in some ways more bitter and sweet. What you say is true. Again, without making excuses, he made some poor choices. He was, after all, if you'll pardon me saying, a kid.
Okay.
And left to his own devices, he made some foolish errors. Starting right there in Silver City, were really a petty crime, which could have been solved very easily, put him in a panic. And when he made his jail escape by shinning up the chimney of that old jailhouse and going on the scout, as we call it when someone goes out on the trail, that was a major mistake, because the sheriff, whose own children played with Billy, literally, was about to bring him home from jail, kind of a scared, stiff situation where he was trying to just teach him a lesson, and he was going to bring him home for dinner that night. Mm-hmm. And instead, the kid's out on the lam, and that's when the trouble really began.
And that was, at that time, he was 15?
Yes.
15 years old, so that was his first time in jail and also his first escape.
That's right. And he was pretty good at escape, you know. I must say, you know, I grew up in Missouri, a great outlaw state. We produced some of the best outlaws in the country in Missouri, from the James boys to Cole Younger and his kin to Bell Starr and others. And as I like to remind my Oklahoma friends, because I'm now a naturalized Okie, we promptly sent them down from Missouri down here to Indian Territory. But growing up as a boy playing cowboys and Indians and outlaws, the story we were given, of course, of Billy the Kid was totally wrong, that he was a psycho, that he killed 21 men, one for every year of his life, that his name was really William Bonney, and none of that is true, and that's what I found, that none of that is true.
Yeah. Our guest is Michael Wallace. He's the author of a biography of Billy the Kid. It's titled Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. It's available now in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can go look for it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It's pretty clear that for him, a big turning point in his life was when his mother died and his stepfather wasn't really interested in him, so he was pretty much on his own. He got into some trouble. He was managing to survive. Probably, though, even bigger than that was what happened in Fort Grant in Arizona when he shot someone and the guy died. Francis Cahill was his name. It sounds like he was a bully and pushed the kid a little too hard, and the kid shot him.
Yeah, Wendy Cahill, another Irishman, a bit older and certainly a bit larger or stronger than the kid. And indeed, he did bully this young man and rough him up quite a bit. And eventually, during one of their wrestling matches turned more violent, the kid shot him as they said, gut shot him, which is a slow and painful death. And Windy held on to the next day, but was able to give a deposition, a full written witness statement, talking about how the kid shot him. But at that time, the kid was long gone. Once again, a little phantom. He had taken off. Panic, no doubt, because he knew, either the law, such as it was, would get him and he'd be decorating a cottonwood limb, or some of Windy's cohorts would get him and shoot him and throw him into an arroyo somewhere.
Yeah.
So he took off, and he ran again. And probably in that case, it brought about his survival.
Maybe we could talk about all the names for a little bit. He was born Henry McCarty. We know that his mother was this woman named Catherine McCarty. So he used that name. Apparently, also at some point, he actually took the name of his stepfather. So he called himself William Antrim.
William Antrim, after 1873, after the marriage in Santa Fe, yes.
And then at some point he became William Bonney, and it sounds as if from the book that no one really knows where that name came from.
No, in fact, I have a whole big chapter, a big juicy chapter on that whole Bonney name and the theories that abound. There are some people who insist that it was a family name from his mother's side, the Bonneys that go way back, and that he just assumed that name when he was on the scout during the days of the Lincoln War there in New Mexico Territory. He had been called also not only William Antrim or Billy Antrim, but he was called Kid Antrim also. And kid didn't necessarily mean you were an outlaw. There were a lot of outlaws, the Cherokee Kid and the Apache Kid and so forth. But there were also people called young men like that Kid Smith, Kid Jones, whatever. It was just a common moniker. So he was called Kid Antrim or Billy Antrim or William Antrim. And it was when he came back and eventually assumed that name, William Bonney or Billy Bonney, that was the name that stuck, that people thought was his given name. And in fact, it wasn't. And I even explore the fact that he was a great reader of the dime novels himself. And there was a popular dime novelist of that name, and there was a popular subject, was a woman named Anne Bonney, who was a swashbuckling lady pirate. So it's hard to say if he just grasped that name from his consciousness, from memory, from family or whatever, but that's the name he went by, and that's largely the name he was stuck with. But most of the time in that whole period, the last few years of his short life, he was called the kid. And it really wasn't until the last 9 months of his life that it was an editor in the paper in Las Vegas, New Mexico Territory, that connected him, and he was called for the first time in print in that last year of his life, Billy the Kid.
And that wasn't a name that he hung on himself.
Definitely not. No. No, definitely not. And you know, of course, he wasn't an outlaw in the classic sense of the word. People need to know that. He didn't rob banks, nor stage coaches, nor, you know, sit around in these Hollywood, these fanciful gun duels in the street. So much of that has been sanitized and romanticized. You know, we all grew up with Westerns where all these grown men sat around in saloons and pristine leather vests, smoking cheroots, and all the soiled doves were gorgeous, and the whiskey flowed, and they had these great shootouts at high noon in the street. Well, that really didn't happen, and it certainly didn't happen at any time in the life of the kid.
Yeah. It certainly, though, was many of these places where he lived, it almost goes without saying that they were rough and violent places, and that for somebody to survive, they would have had to have been pretty tough.
Had to be pretty tough, and it gets back to what you observed earlier. The company he kept was not always desirable. He was drawn to older boys and then older men who sort of mentored him and helped him out as he developed his survival skills. He became very good. He was a very good horseman. He could ride like the wind. He'd shoot very well. He was very proficient with both a handgun and long gun. And he was an agile sort of cat-like young man. But what I'm most attracted by was the fact, and what I really suggested in the book that people have seized on, not only critics but readers and other historians, is this whole Hispanic connection. And I don't want to get into that now if you're going to get into it later, but I think that's a very interesting part of his life. He was proficient. He spoke Spanish like a native. He lived by his wits. He was very much like Charlie Floyd, Pretty Boy Floyd, many years later, sort of like a Viet Cong, like a guerrilla fighter. These were guys who could get along out in the countryside and pay their own way and get the goodwill of the people, the common folk, and so forth. The historical term for these folks are social bandits, someone who gives the disenfranchised, the downtrodden, in the case of New Mexico Territory, i.e. the Hispanic population put upon by a lot of the Anglo money people, the Santa Fe ring out of the capital of the territory, and that bunch who were pirating away land and minerals and rights and property. And the kid came to represent this champion of those people. And even to this day, in parts of New Mexico and Arizona, but mostly New Mexico, I find that the kid is still talked about and revered as a folk hero.
I guess that would also explain something of, with some people, something of the appeal of him and his story. That would it be too much to invoke the Robin Hood image?
Well, yeah, it probably. I mean, yeah, the Robin Hood image was evoked with a lot of outlaws. Certainly with Jesse James, who had a Confederate, if you will, on the staff of the Kansas City newspaper, who might as well have been his press agent, and James was greatly romanticized. But a lot of these people were, and many years later, during the Great Depression, the primary social bandit, Pretty Boy Floyd, was called the Sagebrush Robin Hood. And in both the case of Pretty Boy and the kid, I found that, and I was actually greatly surprised to find that some of those stories were indeed true. And in both cases, there were acts of charity. Now, in the case of Floyd, in the case of the kid, they might not have been. They were smart, clever fellows, and they knew that to win the goodwill of the people, they had to do something for them, you know, leave them a dollar under the plate or do something else helpful to these people. One of Floyd's favorite tricks was tearing up unrecorded mortgages during a bank robbery before they could be recorded, which endeared him to a lot of people, to focus on banks that were foreclosing on these dirt farmers of Oklahoma and Kansas and Missouri. In the case of the kid, there seems to be not a racist bone in his body in a land and time when racism was rampant. And by devouring the Hispanic culture in terms of even some of his dress, the cuisine, particularly the music. He was Irish, remember, and learned his lessons well from his very musical mother. He was a hit at the in the small New Mexican towns at the fandangos and dances with the senoritas, and there are many, many stories of him. And of course, that also adds to the romance element of the kid.
Yeah. Well, we're in our midpoint here. Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Michael Wallace. He's the author of a number of books, over 14, including Pretty Boy, The Life of Charles Arthur Floyd. He also helped bring about the great revival of Route 66 in the 1990s with his journalistic and photographic travelogue, Route 66. He's a member of the Oklahoma Writers Hall of Fame and is the author of Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. It's a biography of Billy the Kid. The book's now available in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions? Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Probably, you know, we've talked about a number of things that we could point to as formative experiences, but I guess if there was one time, one place, one series of events that made him more than anything else, I suppose that would have to be the Lincoln County War, which is, to me, an amazing story. I'm sure a lot has just been written about the Lincoln County War. In brief, and it sounds as if essentially that's it's like the Sopranos in the Old West. It's like two gangs and their hired guns slugging it out to see who's going to be the guys who get to call the shots and make whatever money there is to be made and hold the reins of power.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. I mean, the bottom line is always the bottom line. It was a war of money. It was a war of greed. It was a war, and I didn't coin this phrase, Robert Utley, the distinguished historian, called it a war with no heroes. And in fact, it was a war with no heroes. And that includes the kid. But essentially, you had two sides. It wasn't black and white. There were certainly shades of gray. But you had these the powerful Santa Fe Ring, as it came to be known. There were a lot of rings, political rings, rings of corruption, ranging from Boss Tweed in New York to the corruption during the post-Civil War years through the Depression of 1873 with the rise of more outlaws, the Grant administration, and other administrations. And the tentacles reached out to New Mexico territory, where you had two very powerful forces in Santa Fe, both natives of Missouri, who moved west after the Civil War, Thomas Catron, Boss Catron, Tom Catron, a wily old fox, and you had Stephen Elkins, Smooth Steve Elkins. Both of them eventually became U.S. senators. Catron, the first one, for the then state of New Mexico in 1912, and Elkins back in West Virginia. And these guys really called the shots out there. And their ring extended down in southern New Mexico, of course, in the Lincoln County, where they had a great many recruits from the Army, a lot of Irish, a lot of people who had come out with General Carleton from California in the 1860s and stayed on. And they were totally corrupt. They were in the mercantile business. They ran the trading posts. They were the sutlers at the forts. They had the company stores, such as the House, it was called, in the town of Lincoln, the epicenter of this whole thing. And so you had them grabbing land, forcing people into foreclosures, into bankruptcy, stealing land rights. And then on the other side, in the Lincoln County War, you had a couple of idealistic young men, Tunstall and McSween, a Scotsman, a former seminary student, and McSween, Alexander McSween, and then John Tunstall, an English, young English remittance man who was trying to make his fortune in the New World, and they took on the ring for control of this of the commercial interests there. It was much more than a war, than the classic cattle war. Mm-hmm. It was not. It was much more. It was a war of race, It was a war of religion. It was a war of creed. It was a very emotional, difficult struggle. And the regulators who rode for that McSween Tunstall faction included a young man known as the Kid, as Kid Antrim, a.k.a. Billy Bonney, William Bonney, and Billy the Kid. And it was not a long, long war, but over the time that it ensued, there were great acts of violence and people killed, and just through sheer attrition, this young man, the Kid, worked his way up through the ranks to eventually become the leader of these regulators.
Yeah, and this was the faction, the people that were allied with Tunstall, and I guess the thing that really, there's a complicated context for this, but the thing that really touched off the war was when he was gunned down in cold blood by the House people, and that right. set up this sort of cycle of revenge killings, of reprisals, where you had the regulators organize themselves into this sort of quasi-legal outfit going after people that they believe were responsible for Tunstall's murder.
Right, and all this tit and tat, tit yeah. for tat went back and forth, and the vendetta. And all the while, the real loser, of course, were the small landowners and the citizenry caught in this incredible crossfire, and it involved the United States Army. Look at New Mexico, and it's appropriate to use this metaphor, I guess. It's a big stew pot. It's a big, rich chili, and this concoction includes all sorts of diverse elements. You had African-American soldiers, Buffalo soldiers. You had unreconstructed Confederates, actually shootists and man killers coming over from Texas, bitter and cynical and crazed and full of hate after the Civil War. And they didn't cotton much to African-Americans, nor to Indians, nor to Mexicans or any kind of Hispanic. And then you had the Irish versus English. You had Protestant, Catholic. It was something. The Santa Fe Ring even was able to use the Masonic Order and the Masonic lodges as secret meeting places for their clandestine activities. And they moved the rules around a little bit to allow Hispanics, Jews, and Hispanic Roman Catholics into the Masonic Order and become part of the ring. A lot of them who managed to live old lives, those Hispanics, interestingly enough, what we learned is at the very end, just to be safe, they went back to the Mother Church. they got away from the whole Masonic business. So that's not an indictment, by the way, of the Masons or the Masonic. I'm not anti-Masonic in this presentation, but it is a fact that this core group did do that and use them, meaning those Masonic calls, to their benefit.
All right. We're going to have another call here. We're going to take in just a moment. But first, we need to do this, and it'll take about 2-3 seconds. We've got to do a transmitter switch, so hang on. And this is WILL Urbana. You're listening to Focus 580. Just want to tell you again, our guest this morning is Michael Wallace, and we're talking about Billy the Kid, a subject of his biography, Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. It's published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk to somebody in St. Charles, up in the northern part of the state here, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good interview. I was wondering how much of this Billy the Kid is fact and how much is fiction, and the part that's fiction, who started it? You know, like all the rumors and from what TV guys would, because I grew up thinking, one thing, because I'm 51, It's like the cowboy and Indian bit. Everybody thought the Indians were the bad guys when, in fact, they weren't.
Right.
Get off and listen. Thank you.
Sure.
You betcha. Well, I've kind of covered that, but just to sum that up again, first of all, it really started from the get-go. And the home myth building and the concoction started by Pat Garrett when he penned with a ghostwriter the first big biography of the kid written after his death. But even before that, yellow journalists, pulp writers, the so-called dime novelists, were already feeding the frenzy, not just about the kid, but about everybody, from the Earps, natives of the great state of Illinois, by the way, to Hickok, to these lawmen who easily could have traded hats with the people they were trading. In fact, there were really no black and white hats. They were really gray hats pretty much across the board. But they were made into these grandiose figures, both outlaws and lawmen alike, right from the start. And then through the years with the kid and focusing on the kid, depending on the writer or later the filmmaker, he was treated either, as I said, either as a devil or an angel. But in the mid-20s, Walter Noble Burns wrote a big biography of the kid. And this saga was published by Doubleday and became the blueprint, really, for the modern era interpretation of Billy up until not too long ago. And there's a lot good about that book and a lot that it needs a little work. It was, by the way, the first Book of the Month Club selection ever. But it inspired all the filmmakers, and then you had all the films emerge with Johnny Mac Brown and Paul Newman and Kris Kristofferson, and all and Young Guns, which became a cult film not too many years ago, and they all just missed the mark a bit, as movies often do, and with composite characters and rewriting and of history, but. That's not to say some of them were actually pretty good movies. There's a lot I like about Young Guns, but if you look at these movies or read those books, you're not going to get an accurate portrayal or story of the kid. As I said, there have been hundreds and hundreds of books written about this young man, and one would think everything's been said, but indeed it hasn't. There's always a new interpretation. There's a new angle. There's a new approach. And out of all those hundreds of books, I'd probably say about a half dozen of them are really worthwhile. With that said, I'm also very nervous, as an author should be, because when my book first came out last year in hardcover, and many critics, including some of the best in the land from Los Angeles and New York and American Heritage and others, termed this book probably the best book ever written about the kid, and some called it, went so far as to call it, the definitive book about the kid. And I take exception with that, because I don't think you'll ever, ever have a definitive book about the kid. That will be impossible. We'll just never know. We'll never have the answers to all of our questions. But all we can do, those of us who choose to interpret his life, is do the best job we can and lay it out.
Yeah. Well, again, the book is Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. It's out now in paper, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest Michael Wallace. And questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we talked about the fact that a lot has been said and written about him that's not true. One of the things that perhaps people have heard, and I think that you mentioned it, is that it was said that he had killed 21 men, and that would be one for every year of his life. I think you would say that, in fact, that among the exaggerations, that's one, and that probably the number is more like about half that?
Oh, not even that.
Not even that.
I know for sure that he killed four men. starting with Wendy Cahill.
Yeah.
And then the two deputies when he escaped from the Lincoln County Jail, and then another man and a bar mix-up scuffle after that. He wasn't convicted of those crimes. He was convicted of shooting a sheriff in Lincoln County during the war in a skirmish where many bullets were flying, and we don't know for sure if it was the kid's bullet or not that even hit Sheriff Brady. He may have killed as many as six. I'd say at least half of them needed killing. So it's hard to say. He definitely didn't kill 21 men, and it would be well under 10 men that he did kill.
We have some other callers here to talk with. Let's talk with someone who is calling in from Arthur, Illinois. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for the program today.
Sure.
It's very interesting. A couple of questions. One is how, and I might have missed this, but how old was Billy when he died? And secondly, there was that always that part of the legend that Billy lived on. People thought he was dead.
Right.
I was interested in that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. As far as we know, and when I say we, it's not just the royal we. It's myself and others who I respect that have been working on this young man's life for many years. He was born on a there are two most accepted birth dates, but the year would be 1859. It would make him, when he was killed, 21 years old. And as far as the circumstances of his death, there's no one who's reasonably intelligent who believes that he was not killed that night, July 14th, 1881, at Fort Sumner, New Mexico, from a bullet fired from the gun of Pat Garrett in Pete Maxwell's bedroom, and that he was stone cold dead and buried the next day in the Post Cemetery. Now, whether his bones are still there or not is up for grabs, because there was everything from a major flood of the Pecos River, which washed that cemetery out, to removal of soldier graves to the National Cemetery in Santa Fe, and might have scooped up some of the civilians. But he was, in fact, the next morning buried in that plot dead, wrapped up in a shirt pinned behind his back that was way too big for him, and his body washed and prayed over by a lot of the Hispanic people there who loved him. Not only with Billy, but with other outlaws. And we went through this some years ago with Jesse James, too, to the point of having to exhume his old bones up in Missouri. We always like to keep these guys alive. And, you know, and we do it with other figures from history, too. Somewhere, I guess, in the jungles of Brazil, there's a big poker palace, and there you'll find John Kennedy and Elvis Presley and Billy the Kid and so forth, all having a high old time. But the fact is that these people did die. Billy was killed that midnight where he was, and that's the truth. You have people emerging like this Brushy Bill, who came up many, many years ago as an old guy down in Texas and claimed to be Billy the Kid. We had the same thing with Jesse James, with a man named J. Frank Dalton, who emerged at a lot in Oklahoma in the late 40s and was said to be Jesse James. And they even brought him up to my Route 66 at Merrimack Caverns in Missouri and put him on display. Well, it was just bogus. These guys were not who they said they were. It was illusions of grandeur and fraud. So that's the truth of that, and you can take that to the bank.
He was Billy was killed by Pat Garrett. We generally know the circumstances. It was at a friend's house. It was nighttime. Garrett was there waiting for him. Billy comes in, and it's dark, and he's not quite sure who's there, what's going on. Maybe he's a little uneasy. Maybe if you were him, you would be. And it is said that his last words were something like, he was not sure who was there, who might be in the room, and it was said that his last words were something like, Who is it, or who's there? Who maybe quién es? He asked. He said it in Spanish, and then apparently in English. So the last words were, "Who is it?" And you like that in a sense because it maybe that is the ultimate question about this man, who was he really?
Yeah, I think that's such a fitting way. That's why I described the death briefly, of course, in the prologue, right up front, and then I described the death again. Obviously at the end of the book, but he did die died without his boots on. He was in his stocking feet. He had just come down with a butcher knife, in fact, which I've held, to cut a hunk of meat off of a yearling, just slaughtered, hanging from a viga, a beam up in the portal. And that's when he stumbled into these shadowy deputies hunkered down outside Pete Maxwell's bedroom door, which opened to the outside. And when he stepped inside to talk to Pete Maxwell, whose sister Billy was quite close to and may have even impregnated, and he asked him in Spanish, you know, "Pete, who is it? Who are those men outside?" And then he sent someone else in the room, Kenneth, and then he was killed by Garrett, who fired directly into him. Garrett had gone in there to ask Pete where he was, and so he died without his boots on, hungry, with a question unanswered on his lips. And but as I point out, that night, at that moment, Garrett killed, in fact, Henry McCarty. But the kid still lives. His ride continues. It's an endless ride.
So did this, what did this, the fact that he had killed this very famous bad man, what did this do for Pat Garrett?
Well, in some ways it was the kiss of death, because he was ingratiated him with some people. He became a hero with other people. People even raised money for him. He got a modest reward for doing this. Garrett had questions of integrity and perhaps some lawlessness in his own background, as I said earlier, a lot of these folks did. And he went on to serve some more time as a lawman and did some ranching for a while, was a customs inspector in El Paso until he got involved with some shenanigans, and Teddy Roosevelt didn't reappoint him. And then he died a very unglamorous death himself in 1908. This tall, very tall, lanky old sheriff, Pat Garrett, stopped his wagon on the road in southern New Mexico, traveling with some other folks, and was actually relieving himself along the road when he was bushwhacked, shot in the back, and killed. And they still laughingly and lovingly say in southern New Mexico it was death by urination. But that was it. And that was the end of Pat Garrett. In the 70s, about 74, I think, I had the occasion of spending time with Jarvis Garrett, Pat's youngest son. And then that day, he allowed me to hold the gun that Garrett used to shoot the kid. Now, that gun is now in a private collector's hands, but at that time, it was passing through Jarvis Garrett's possession. And that was when Garrett warned me. This is years before I even thought I'd write a book about the kid. That he said, "Be careful. There are so many traps out there, so many lies. Writers tend to let their imaginations run away with them."
Yeah. So, how did that feel when you were handling that that 44 revolver that had been Pat Garrett's and that had killed Billy the Kid?
Well, I've had similar moments in my work as a journalist and then as a writer of books. I'm now doing a book about another mythologized hero, which would give us fodder for yet another program with you in a couple of years. I'm doing a book about David Crockett, Davy Crockett, as you would know. I mean, never signed his name, Davy. And I just recently held his very first rifle from when he was about an 11-year-old boy. And it's an interesting feeling because, especially with the Garrett gun, Crockett ended up owning a lot of different guns and was best remembered for one called Old Betsy, which was actually a prize gun that he was given by the Young Men of Philadelphia during a book tour. But with the Garrett gun, this gun had belonged to one of Billy's pals, and Garrett had taken it off of him after he shot it, and it ended up being the gun that he used to kill the kid with. And so when I held it, even then, not knowing nearly what I know now about the kid, I realized that this was, you know, really, as they say, a piece of history, and treated it as such.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'd certainly recommend to people take a look at Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. It's a great story by our guest Michael Wallace. It's available now in paperback. That's published by W.W. Norton. You might also take a look at his books, Pretty Boy, The Life of Charles Arthur Floyd, and his book, Route 66. Mr. Wallace, thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure. I always like visiting with friends from the Midwest, and especially the land of Lincoln.
All right, very good.